Hello. Welcome to the last session of the day on day one of TechEd. Thank you for putting up with it all today of all these PowerPoint presentations with bullet points and lists of things to remember. I'm not going to do that to you. I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to try and tell you some stories. And if we're lucky, this technology might work. Bear with me. Now the technology might work. My name is Martin Sykes. I work for Microsoft for my sins. I've been here for 7 years. I work in the Center of Excellence for Enterprise Strategy. That's a very small team in part of the Microsoft Services corporate function. It's a very small team today because I am one of only two people in it. The second person joined Friday of last week. A couple of days from now, we'll have number three. By the end of the next month, we'll up to about seven. And what we do is look after our enterprise architects around the world, nearly 400 of them, who are out there working for our customers. And a part of my job is to interview those enterprise architects to work out whether they're the sort of people we want to have in our organization. And I ask them all sorts of strange, weird, and wonderful questions, as you might expect being from Microsoft. And some of them are around their soft skills, their ability to tell stories, their ability to influence an audience, to do something, to make change happen, to help them in their organization. But I want to give you a little bit of a background here on myself. I wasn't always in this sort of a role. I didn't get born to be an enterprise architect. In fact, if I go back to the late 1990s, I was a deep geek. I started out in artificial intelligence and image processing for robotic control, driving robots under the North Sea, flying robots, and real-time control systems with multiple robotic units, all seeing where they could go. And then there was a transformation, as I did a little bit of a business degree, but also started to get responsibility for driving programs of work with senior stakeholders. That was 1999 when things changed. I'm going to go back to that in a moment. But since then, I've learned a lot of things. Last year, I ended up having a book published. So if you like what you see here, a lot of the content is actually in this. If you can't get a physical copy down here, you can go and buy the electronic version from the Wiley website. It's huge because it's a very graphical book all the way through, so don't try buying it from Amazon. They don't like the amount it costs to get the download coming through, but the Wiley site has it all in there for you. I've just mentioned that now, so you get a chance to think also about what language variation you might want. In just the last 6 months, we've already got it out in 3 more languages, and there's another 4 coming over the next year. I never wanted to write a book. Never thought I was going to write a book. But I got my arm twisted by people who I'd worked with. Because along the way, I used to tell stories. And the reason why I started telling stories went back to 1999. I was an enterprise architect, freshly minted enterprise architect, with a team. And we'd gone and put together an architecture that was going to change things. It was logically consistent. It had layers. It had vertical bits. It had all sorts of cool stuff in there. It had diagrams with lots of boxes and arrows on it. Yeah. And we were about ready to get all the approvals. Everything was about right. And then we heard that the senior management team had bought MQ Series from IBM. I wasn't in Microsoft at the time, so it wasn't a case of, you know, it was Microsoft or anything else, but we'd picked a different product. And no matter what we did over the next month, we couldn't change their minds. They decided MQ Series was right for the organization. And that logically consistent architecture we'd got had to be twisted slightly at an angle to make any of it work with MQ Series. This was architecture by vendor. How did they do it? They told a story to the senior execs that the senior execs liked better than our story. They'd hit them with the emotional lump. And we didn't get that. So that started the quest for me to learn how to tell stories. As it happens today, I'm in Microsoft teaching our internal people how to tell stories to customers so that they take our architecture. But that's just a strange way the world goes sometimes. But prepare to share how we do it and why we do it with you. Because storytelling makes things happen. We are not computational processors up here, like silicon chips. People often relate the brain to silicon chips, you know, how much processing capacity is there. These aren't computational processors. These are story processors. Lots of the evidence over the last 20 years has shown narrative structure helps to stick information in the brain. If you have a story structure around your information, it helps it stick up here. Even if you're a detail-oriented person, all about the numbers, if you've got a narrative structure that helps hold those numbers together, you can remember them better. Now, if you want somebody to make a decision, you actually need them to remember what the heck you're talking about. Yeah? So first of all, narrative helps in retention. Secondly, narrative helps by relating what it is you're talking about to the experience of the audience. We think and we remember in the stories and sequence of events that happen to us. So if you can align with that sort of structure, you can get things straight into people's brains without them even realizing it. Straight past the logical filters and straight into their consciousness and unconscious mind. So as we were putting this content together a few years ago, one of my colleagues told me a little story about his time in the U.S. Army. So Al Noel, he's one of our principal consultants in the U.S., lovely guy to work with. He used to be in the infantry in the U.S. Army. Very early days, long time ago, when helicopters were a new thing for the U.S. infantry. And this is not his helicopter at the time. The image that they showed is no longer available for me to work with, but I thought this one appropriate because that's sitting down in the South Island where I was a few years ago taking this picture myself from a helicopter. And I just managed to find a little Chinook that drops in there quite nicely to get the point across. But Al and all his colleagues were sitting there listening to a presentation from the generals telling them, you guys are going to get in helicopters. These are infantrymen. They walk. Their whole purpose in life is on foot. Perhaps you might be armored infantry with a truck, but you're on the ground. You don't fly. Flying is for those other guys over there who aren't really soldiers. We are soldiers. So half an hour of presentation about how they were changing, what was going to happen to them, and the room was hostile. It's like me telling all of you guys, you're going to owe me social workers. Forget this stuff. You don't want to do it. It's not your jobs. It's got nothing to do with what you do. And that was what they were feeling. And then somebody put a picture up like this and talked about the situation. You're over here. Your dozen guys have got to get over there to the top of the valley. Set up camp, protect the pass. You look at that image. You know that water is only just above freezing. It is knee-thigh deep mud. You've got to trudge through that and then set up. Helicopter gets you there in 15 minutes. Job done. And then you actually do the job you're paid for. You protect the pass. Now, which one do you want? As soon as they had the image, that was it. The whole room is, I'm in. Show me the helicopter. We're going. That little trick of telling them a story that relates to something meaningful to them with the right image made the difference. So sometimes the stories we talk about do not need to be long stories, but the part of the story needs to fit very clearly with the person. Now, a lot of people do research on stories, and some people do good presentations on them at university level. This is Stanford University in the U.S., and there is an MBA course there. So this is supposed to be some of the best and brightest minds in the U.S. at one of the best and brightest universities doing a business degree course. And they have a presentation from a guy called Chip Heath. And he gives them data and asks them to do their own short presentations to their colleagues based on that data. And at the end of their little presentations, he plays a comedy video to distract them all. And then he asks the audience, what did you remember? Okay. Not a lot of data, but the best of the best and the brightest. 10% of them tell stories. That's 90%. Just put the bullet points on a slide. Slap the stuff up and then talk about it. Of those 10% that tell a story, there is a 65% retention rate for the contents that they have described to the audience. It's pretty good going. What do you think the retention rate is for the 90% that didn't use story narratives? Come on, give me some numbers. 5% retention. The best of the best talking to the brightest of the brightest in a place like Stanford. 5% retention. using your normal PowerPoint deck. Think about that. How many of those sessions have you been to today with all those bullet points all the way down the screen? How much are you going to remember tomorrow morning? How much are you going to remember after the party tomorrow night? Yeah? A week from now. It diminishes rapidly. But narrative actually helps some of this stuff stick in your head. And I will bet you, a year from now, you could talk with a colleague and say, do you remember that storytelling session? Oh, yeah, I remember that bit with the helicopter. Yeah, the little narratives I use in here will stick. But there's a myth I want to get rid of. The myth of the silver bullet. Just using a story isn't going to fix everything. Or any other technique, any other guru will stand up and tell you, just do this and your life will be great. Sorry, it ain't that easy. What we identified over the years that I was working through how to do effective communication and storytelling and influencing was that there's a heck of a lot you've really got to do. And one of the key things is working out what it is you need to do now. And put together this model. We call it CAST, or a visual story map, how to put all your content together. There's four rows on here, which represent the four key areas to think about. That's why we call it CAST. The top row, about your content. Because if you want to get a better presentation, get better content first. And within that, we want to understand why, what, how, and what if. And for those that were in my session earlier today, you might be looking at this thinking, hey, that looks familiar. Yeah. One of the key techniques that I've been using for 15 years now, the Benefits Dependency Network, we've simplified for the storytelling purposes here. We know there's evidence behind it from decades worth of work and thousands of organizations that it's a great tool for really getting you to focus on how to structure your materials. So we use that. And I'll come into that again in a minute to explain how we do it. But the second row here is all about the audience. It's why I wander up and down a little bit. I'm also talking to people all day to find out, who have I got here? Who is in my audience? What do you care about? Why are you sitting in this room? To be entertained. So long as I can be entertaining, I kick a point down here. That's good. I'll try and do more than that for you, though. So I think about, how do you learn? You've all got different approaches to learning. Some of you prefer reading. Some are auditory. Some are visual. Some have to try it for yourselves. There's many different models about learning, many different ways in which you do it. If I just present to you my approach and the way I learn, I'm probably going to get a third of you actively engaging with me, and two-thirds will disconnect. The same is true in decision-making. If I try and express an idea to you in the structure that helps me make a decision, probably only 25 to 30% of you will agree. The others will still be waiting for the sort of information or approach that helps you make a decision. So when you think about how to make your presentation, the second layer here after your content is your audience, and then it becomes iterative, working through what type of audience have you got, what do they know, and what content do you want. And then you might be thinking, hang on a minute, he's got a huge room here. There's going to be every style in the room. Yeah, there is. Which means that when I present to you, I have to ensure that across my content for the 60 minutes, I am covering all of the different styles that you need. It's forced me to consciously think about how to structure this content so that it will hit that for you. The third row here now, we get into the narrative part and the storytelling piece. And first piece here is the structure of the story, what is called the dynamic arc. What's this later? But this part is about how to give across a message in such a way that it sticks with people. How many times do you ever hear a proposal for a project or a change that starts with, this is where we are today, good things will happen, more good things will happen, even better things will happen, ta-da, we're finished. Loads of times. People hide the dirty stuff. But is that an interesting story? Is that one you're going to remember? Usually not. There's no challenge in that. So what we look for in some of this structure is, where is the challenge? And let's actually describe that challenge. The second part are the characters. Let's make it personal. Talking about abstractions doesn't help people relate to things. If you watch the news stories tonight, I'll bet you that within every one of the different news stories that comes up, in the very first part, there'll be a personal piece. A young girl that's suffering from some syndrome, and then how she suffers, but then you can generalize this, and here's the solution that's been applied to it. A person in a car accident, when it goes through. Why do news channels do that? Because we relate to people, we relate to individuals. So when you start talking about what you're going to put in your presentation, think about who are the characters in that story that you can relate to. I've been in a couple of sessions today that have had great content. totally destroyed by the way they were presented, such that nobody in the room, and I asked a few of them, did that resonate with you? And said, no, not quite sure what to do with that. But if the presenter had just twisted it a little to tell a story of how somebody would use that in their real situation and talked about the individual, it would have started clicking straight away with a lot more of them. And talk about the conflict potentially that's in there as well. And here also we'll look at the sense of urgency. Why now? There's not much point in doing a presentation to somebody if they're not going to do something about it. If they're going to put it on a shelf, say, I'll come back to that in a month when it looks nice and I can have some more time for it. Great. But we look to say in a presentation and telling a story, it should finish with some of the people go, yeah, I wanted to act on this. You've influenced them. So we look here at the influencing skills necessary to be able to put across the message in the right way that people act on it. And we use work here from a guy called Caldini, a professor in the US. He and his research team research influencing skills. And the anti-patterns as well to influencing. So if you're being influenced, how to turn the tables on the person influencing you. Great, you know, go and look him up on Amazon and get one of his books. Influence Science and Practice is one I'd recommend. Because you'll save at least 20% the next time you go and buy yourself a car. Because you can kick those sales guys all around the room when you actually know what techniques they're using and the opposites to use with them. I love the stuff. We use that here. And then the next part is delivery planning. How to plan the presentation delivery. Because very often, it's not one shot. I've got one shot with you today. But in part, you're here because you read the brief that I wrote. A lot of time actually went into getting that just right to try and be a nice little tasty hook for this type of audience. And then what follow-up materials would you have? If you're in a larger organization, you've got a story to tell, you may actually think about how to structure that story so that it's built up with some of the audience. They become part of the story in the way it's put across. And then finally, the fourth row, tell. This is where we actually start this using some software to put it together. You might have noticed by this point there's been no mention of startup PowerPoint and put things in it. Actively tell people, start thinking first. PowerPoint and anything like that only comes down here. And in fact, when you've gone through this sort of process, you might find you stop creating presentation slides. You actively start thinking about what's going to influence the audience at a particular point in time, and you might go to a whiteboard instead. And you've got carefully planned out what that whiteboard's going to look like when you finish. So what feels like an interactive discussion, a few little stories you're telling, finishes with a visual on the whiteboard that people don't want to rub off. I'll come back to that point later because it's a key trick we use to get a message stuck with people. And then finally, test. We tested hundreds of presentations from internal people and hundreds from external people to see what had worked and what didn't work. And I'm not worried about whether you can stand up straight, whether you know how to breathe, whether you can talk without going at the end of every sentence. That's the presentation side from the aspect of delivering it. If you've got the best presenter in the world and your content and your story is ineffective, you're still not going to get anywhere. So the tests we have here are all about making sure that what you're trying to deliver is going to be effective for the right person. The trouble is, you know too much. You know far too much. The people you're communicating with don't always need to know it all. But one of the problems we get is people don't think about how to filter that. This is a real example I had in that picture on the back there. Young lady in our organization asked me for some help. I said, what do you need? She said, well, this is my presentation deck right now. And I've got a problem. I'm looking at her thinking, yeah, you've got a problem. There's a lot of slides here for an hour. And she said, I've still got two sections to put in. Okay. Who for? CIO and his leadership team, all about everything they can get out of our enterprise agreement. Right. Why do they care? And she stopped. She hadn't thought about it. What are they going to get out of it? What she was doing was taking all the standard decks and merging them together and saying, this is what we've got to give them because we know all this stuff and we believe when they know all this stuff, they'll be educated and then they'll make wise decisions. No, they'll be asleep and then they'll not ask you back again. So what you're actually looking for is how to take this down. Where did we end up? How many slides do you think were in the final deck? You're pretty close. Six. Six slides. Introduction. Thank you very much. Yeah? Who the people in the room were, and then three slides for the three key priorities of the CIO, that noted what in the enterprise agreement was going to enable them to hit those priorities. That's all that mattered. Everybody else in the room was supporting CAST. If the CIO believed he'd done the right thing, you could then take it to the next level and tell a different story with the next group. And each one of those three had a story associated with it that explained how somebody else had achieved the results that the CIO wanted to achieve with the parts of the enterprise agreement that were relevant. If you don't know why they should care about it, what you can assume is they don't care. I believe that you have some aspect of caring about communicating more effectively. And as I found out in the pre-session discussion and show of hands, everybody here has had something go wrong with them, so would like to make sure it doesn't happen again. So, welcome to Nobody Cares. How do we get out of Nobody Cares? We start by first of all asking the question, why will they care? Every presentation we want to do is to ask somebody in the audience to do something they would not do if we were not there. If they were going to do it anyway, go home, put your feet up, have a beer. You're turning up to influence them to do something they would not do otherwise. So why will they care about it? And there's many different things you can look at here. What's influencing them from the outside world? What's in it for them? There's usually a personal angle you want to understand about it. What alternatives are they considering? Then what to change? Are you asking them to start doing something? To stop doing something? To do something different? And what is often missed out is, what do you not want them to change? Things that are working well, but you don't want them to start assuming they should change that as well in what you're proposing. And then how are they going to get from point A to point B? If you're here in Las Vegas, down here, outside Circus, and you've had enough of all those casinos, it's a great one to put in a casino environment, this. If you've had enough of all those casinos and you want some culture, you want to go over there, the point where it says to here, the Las Vegas Public Library. It's not a very big building. You can get there by being told you've got to do turn-by-turn directions and how the roads look like. You can get that by giving a piece of paper that just shows a few lines on it. And part of thinking about what to have in your story and the message, the how to get there, has to really think about what's the right level of detail for this audience. Do you give them the cliff notes of how to get through, or do you talk them through the experience of it and what it's going to feel like to get there? And there can be transformations, there can be sequences, agreements that have to be made, all sorts of things to think about here. And in 60 minutes, the best I can give you is a taster for this. But the thing to think about is, you've probably got content already. You don't start a presentation with a blank slate in your head, neurons empty. You start with content. The important thing is how to filter it, how to look at your content and say, this part of my message explains why they should change, this part of my message explains what to change, and this explains how to change. And then you might put it together like this, the whys, the whats, and the hows. And notice how I stretch the hows out. There's a sequence in which you can put them in. Key point this. The presenter only has one mouth, and our brains can only process one stream of consciousness at a time. So I don't care how many of your proposals can all be done in parallel in the implementation. You've got to put it in sequence to talk about it, and it has to make sense. That's what we're putting it on the page here for, the sequence you can talk about it for it to make sense. And there's probably some milestones along the way within your story. The reason for doing this is that actually helps us get a story structure. Because stories have a starting point and then things happen. Think about that. Things happen in stories. How many of you here like that sort of French film theater where a guy gets up in the morning, puts the kettle on, has a coffee, sits around his lounge, goes to bed? That's the film. Yeah? How many of you watch those? Okay, I'm not expecting any hands now. Nobody's going to admit to that in this room, are they? But outside of that style of film, every other style of film has something that's different. It has action. It has things happening to people. It's not just exposition telling you about the world. Things are happening. So when you look at a story, it's the how that you're actually telling. The why and the what set the scene and give you the justification. They tell you why the hero is trying to do something. They tell you why the villain is preventing it. And they tell you what the context is. but you've got to cut it back. Bruce Lee did not become the best martial artist on the planet by practicing 10,000 moves. He had a very small number of moves, but he practiced each one of them 10,000 times a month. He was very good at very few things. And that should be the same when you're thinking about putting your presentations together. Terracotta warriors, at first glance, they all look the same. Grey figures. But when you get close to them, like any audience, they're all different. Every single one is unique. So we've moved now from the content row into the audience row. What we have to think about is, why should the audience be listening to us? And what does each one of them have? Even with an audience this big, I start thinking about the personas for different groups in the room. I know I'm going to have some DBAs, some people who are in DevOps. There's going to be some consultants in here. There's going to be managers of teams, solution architects, enterprise architects. Different skill levels, different life experiences, different attitudes. Which of those can I pull together to find something that I can actually get to relate to in the stories? If this white space up here is everything that could ever be known about storytelling, that circle is what I know about it inside that space. The blue circles represent a selection of people from this audience. Because of our experiences and our backgrounds, we have some areas of overlap, but there's definitely some areas of difference. If I'm going to start a conversation with you, where do I start? I start in that bit in the middle, where we've got something in common. No matter how far I want to take you out into things I know about that you don't know about, I start in somewhere where we have common ground, and then I build out from it. Where did I start today? Common ground of we've all had painful presentations. And along the way, in what I talk with you about, I can keep taking you back to various aspects of common ground experiences that we will have had. And if, for example, you find yourself in a situation pertaining to an audience where you've got no idea what ground you've got in common from the content you're going to talk about, pick something else that is a life experience you probably do have in common that you can use as a metaphor, as an example of the change you're going to talk about. One that I use from time to time is learning how to drive. How many people here cannot drive a car? Cool. Excellent answer. Everybody can drive. Do you remember that first time you get behind the wheel? And you're sitting there, an instructor or your parents are telling you, right, you've got the wheel, your stick shift probably in this country as well, the gear sticks, the pedals, all these little bits to play with your fingers. And they say, okay, so lift the clutch up gently and accelerate, and thump. That was usually most people's first experience with a car. Or if you're in an automatic acceleration, it's going faster than you can control, so you brake fast. But that's where we all start with it. So you could take that as a first experience of what's it like to go from nice internal development environment to your IT organization is now in the cloud. Welcome to hell. It's like learning to drive all over again, because everything you thought you knew how to do is going to be different. So you can start there, making a relationship and a connection with your audience. And that's how you get over those guys that are on the red circle, the ones that have nothing in common with the topic you want to talk about. You find a different topic that they can relate to. There are loads of great quotes about storytelling. But when you're thinking about how to put your stories together and your presentations, you don't need to deliberately tell them the sequence they have to go through. If you want somebody to go and change major parts of their business process, you don't want to tell them the sequence they've got to go through for all the activities. They can work that one out themselves. You want to tell them what the world is going to be like when the change happens. As it says here, to make them yearn for the outcome, to make them have a passion and emotional connection for where you want them to be. So, 2,480 or so years ago, there was a guy called Aristotle, famous Greek, and he wrote a number of treatises. One of them was all about storytelling. And he had three acts in his stories: the setup, the confrontation, and the resolution. Now, the Greeks had a particular frame of mind that meant most of his stories were tragedies. One core particular style. But if we look fast forward to the 20th century, The best people writing stories for film and theater started expanding out this model, and there are various models out there you could pick from, but the one we use is the five acts that starts with this setup and says, setup is two parts. The first is explain the way the world is in equilibrium, the normal day to day. Then something happens. It's disrupted the world for the hero, and they start to react to that disruption. That we call the inciting incident. In this particular case, it could be Windows 8 was introduced. And it's like, oh my God, what do we do now? And there's a slow reaction to it in the marketplace, and you have to respond to that happening to you. During the reaction phase, there comes a point of no return. Windows XP is dead. Sorry, you can't use it anymore. You're gonna have to change. So at that point, things are moving along, and what we call the tension is increasing. There is no resolution yet, and you're still struggling in some way with it. But at some point, you think you've solved the problem. And here it's almost like me. I've had a problem, I've reacted against it, it's looking good. And what you want in a good story is a little twist, where everybody in the audience goes, oh, it's not fixed, it's not right. And then after that, there's a struggle. The struggle that actually goes on with the hero takes an active part in working out how to resolve the problem until the climax. How am I doing for time? Because I'm going to start jumping around the stage if I've got enough time for it. Yeah, let's do this. Okay. Who remembers the A-Team TV show? Yes, that'll do nicely. The rest of you, you're just going to have to work along with this one. Half a dozen series of a handful of guys who did the same thing every week. I've got a problem. I find a man in disguise, probably in drag or he's an old guy or something like that, but he says, I can help you. You go back home and this team turns up. And the bad guy could be some landlord that's trying to throw you off your farm or some local developer who wants to take all the water supply. And the team turns up, sees who it is, thinks, we can push him around for a while now, we'll make this change happen, no problem. There's a little bit of a confrontation. What happened next? The A-Team had underestimated the situation. The bad guy has actually got links to the mob, and around the corner come 30 guys with guns. Oh, hell. Ah, that's the false hope. Okay, the team runs away. They find a barn. They get the truck in the barn. Two oxyacetylene torches, two spare tractors, and half a dozen machine guns later, and you now have a flying tank. They build a ramp. It shoots out through the door, lands. The suspension is okay on a 2-ton truck. No problem whatsoever. Flies around in a big wheel, taking a pot shot at everybody. Nobody gets hit. Nobody dies, but everybody lies down on the ground all of a sudden. The team wins. They've had the final confrontation. Oh, no, not quite. You're still struggling. The boss is getting away. Hannibal or one of the other chasing around the corner. Bit of a fist fight. He's out. Tie him up. You hear the sirens. It's the military police. The guys are away around the corner. All of a sudden, the bits that the tractor was welded onto the van have disappeared, and the van gets away. Every week through 6 seasons. A little bit of change every now and then with who the girl was that was the reporter for them, or who the military police guy was, or whether this time they were working for the government. A little bit of backstory change. Everything else was the same. Why? Why did you watch it? It was awesome. Yes, it was awesome. It had a plot that looked like this over and over again. Now, behind the scenes, there could be one core model, there could be 7 different styles, tragedies, comedies, action ones. Different people have researched the market and said different numbers. In the book, we decided to pick the guy that said there are 7. Not because he's right, but because 35 is too many to try and work out your options, and 1 is a bit restrictive. So we said, 7. That works for us. I don't believe there's a right answer here. I think there are answers that help us think. This is not a formulaic approach with the cast stuff. It's one that tells you, sorry guys, it's not going to be easy doing storytelling and presentations. You're going to have to learn how to think, but let's give you some tools. Tools that help you go through all the different stages. And then there's the characters. Have you heard the phrases antagonist and protagonist? About, you know, the different parties that have a conflict. They're great if you're in academia. Let's put those to one side. I hate them. Because what they get rid of is the emotional context. Yeah? The phrases I like to use are hero and villain. They are the two parties in our story. The hero wants to have a particular outcome that you are supporting. The villain is a person or a culture or another organization that wants a different outcome. Treat it as simple as that. But you want to try and get some emotional mix into it. I'm not suggesting you tell your presentation to your CIO, here's the hero and here's the villain of the story. That's in your head, but you know then how to change your language and your perspective when you've got this sort of model. And the hero and the villain are in conflict over the goal of the story. Now, this guy called Vladimir Propp, back 100 years ago, analyzed some great pieces of storytelling work, fairy tales. And he looked at them and said, what are the key characters? And he found there's a role called a dispatcher that sends the hero on their way. There may be a helper that works with the hero. He's not the hero himself, but he's got to have guts and character to work with him. There may be the donor that provides key technology or a key artifact to make things work. The princess sometimes is the personification of the goal, that the hero is after getting the princess. And again, I don't recommend you tell your key stakeholders this is the princess in the story. Doesn't quite work. And there could be a false hero that everybody thinks, yes, that's the one we want. It's VMware. It's VMware. It's not. Okay? But what's the important point here? As the presenter, you are not the hero. You are the narrator of a story that the people in the audience can relate to. And most of them, you hope, will put themselves in the position of the hero. A few may consider themselves the donor. You're in trouble if a member of the audience considers themselves the villain. You don't want to call it out, but you're going to have to work on it. So, take a look at this little picture. This is a great kid. He's 11 years old. Every year, I go and work and spend a week to 10 days on a children's camp in Ireland, a place called Barrettstown. It's beautiful. I've been there for 11 years now. And the thing about Barrettstown is we have 100 children in that time who are all recovering from cancer and leukemia. These kids, in many cases, haven't actually had a life. They've spent it in hospital. And we take children from all across Europe. A few years ago, this particular kid we had here was from Russia. He was in the cottage that I was working with. He'd had two brain tumors and cancer in his leg. We didn't know he was going to live or not. He was in remission to be able to come onto the camp. And he and other boys there, some of the brightest, smartest kids I've ever had the opportunity to work with. He knew no English. But by the end of the week, he was able to have a faltering conversation with me. And he told me about his life in Russia. The grey pajamas, the grey ward. You know, these kids, when they came out of the dining hall at lunchtime, would sneak fruit out because they didn't think they'd get it later. And we said, you've got everything here. It's all okay. And you don't know here where this kid is alive or dead today. All we can do is work with them at the time they turn up. But we know 10% don't make it to adulthood from the kids that we work with. How do you feel? Pretty low? Yeah. I've told you a story that took me just over 30 seconds to tell it to you. And what's happened is that your brain has released chemicals into your bloodstream. I can have the dancing clowns come in from that side of the room now and the monkeys from that side. And it's going to be hard pushed to raise that mood for the next couple of minutes while your body filters those chemicals back out. People don't need to die in your stories to have an impact. But just think, if that little bit of emotion can change your mood so much, you've got to be able to use emotion in your storytelling as well to tie to things that people matter, or people care about. Okay? Now, there's a video on YouTube by a guy called Zac Efron who has a little cartoon version of this. I don't want to use the cartoon today and pray to the gods of technology it would work and record properly. But if you watch that, what was told in that story is how they put people in MRI scanners and take a constant drip off their blood supply while telling them stories like this. And they've seen the brain and how it's wired and the fact that emotion has an impact. Change the neural pathways, can seriously work through making you do something that you hadn't before planned to do. Yeah? Think how much I changed your minds and your physical feelings in just 30 seconds. So when we talk about stories, well, I want to talk about the emotional side. If you're trying to make change happen, there's another book by Chip and Dan Heath all about making change called Switch. They've got this little example in there of the rider on the elephant. The rider is the logical mind. And most of the time, you can tell the elephant where to go. And that's what most of you are doing in your presentations, I guess. It's the logical side. It's what I was doing in 1999, 2000 with my team. We were that little rider, tacking things along. But if you want to get that elephant through the forest, that rider can do so much. But if the elephant gets spooked, he's going to go in a totally different way. The elephant is your emotional side. It can totally take over your body and your decision-making functions. So what do? You clear a very small path through the forest to make sure it's clear in the direction to go. You set the logical mind, the rider, in such a way that he points the elephant in the right direction. Then you scare the hell out of the elephant. One way of thinking about it. But you motivate the elephant to act in the direction you want it to act. You've cleared a path through all of the things that people have to object to, whatever, and you use the combination of logic and emotion through the power of story. So here's the link to the Zac Efron stuff. How do you feel now? You started warming up a bit, yeah? I've had a few laughs out of the audience. I want to get you back into the lighter-hearted mood before we get on to the next piece. So here's your typical business presentation about haulage services in the USA. Three bullet points. You've probably seen slides like this all day. Here's some numbers. Here's a little bit of fact. 66% of professional freight drivers spend more than 3 nights per week in their trucks. Read this. I don't need to read it out for you. Do you care? I don't. Let me tell you about Bill. Bill is the owner-operator of a big rig in the USA. Bill's been doing this for 14 years. Bill has a wife and family back in Denver, a couple of beautiful young girls who he only ever sees at weekends. And Bill is very often in situations like this in the middle of nowhere. And he's done his driving time for the day. He's got to find a place to park, probably in the back streets of some small town, not quite knowing what sort of situation he's putting himself in. Situations that he doesn't want to be in and situations that his family do not want him to be in. Yeah? He's at risk. Do we want to help Bill? What we've done is make the story specific. I'm not going to the numbers yet. I don't need to. To start with, I set the scene and the context of a specific situation with a character. Bill's not the hero in this story. You're going to be the hero because you're going to keep Bill safe. The goal of this story is keeping Bill safe. The villains are the criminals out there who want to steal stuff from his big rig. Those people who think it's fun to go and torch the rig. Something like that, yeah? So you are the heroes, but you start from the specific, and I'm going to go to the general. And what else might I add to this slide? I don't need you to read all the numbers and all the words. You know, when you have the presentation skills training courses, it usually says don't read your slides. So what should you do differently? Not just a photo. It's not about turning everything into photos. But you might put on there the key number. So for the people that need to know numbers, I've got the number sitting on there. And a little bit of visual design work here using PowerPoint. I use the eyedropper tool. I click on the cab to get the color, and that's what I use as the color to fill the background. So if you're using the latest version of PowerPoint, quick tip here. You want to pick a color to fill a box. Look at your picture you've got as your backdrop and say, what are the color on here would help accentuate the message, connect things together? And then in your fill color, it's a little eyedropper. You can drag it anywhere you want on the screen. As soon as you've clicked the mouse button down anywhere, outside of PowerPoint, anywhere else, it'll go over it, click that color, you've got it. Oops. And then the bottom one down here, 68% of truck drivers will spend more than 3 nights in the cab. Two pieces of data that I can tell a story with that helps that data stick in your head. Tiny little story that only takes a couple of minutes. And that's one of the key tricks here. Trying to put a story together to do a presentation for a half an hour to an hour is hard. It really is. So don't. Do short stories that fit together in sequence. Little cases and examples that take one point at a time and build it up. There's a lady that I love to see in presentations called Alison Levine. I've seen her a couple of times now. She is one of only 30 women on the planet that have climbed the highest peak on every continent and skied to both poles. Amazing adventurer. She's a brilliant presenter. She tells you the story over about a 90-minute period of their ascent on Everest, the last peak. She does it in a sequence of 5 to 10-minute slots, where each part starts with the personal aspect of what her and the team were doing, the hardship they faced, whether it was getting the money to sponsor the event or climbing Everest itself, which is up and down many times before you get to the top. And in each case, there's the specific. Then she generalizes the situation. She did it for Microsoft for a team of project and program managers. And in Microsoft, you turn your laptops on at the start of a meeting, give it a big presentation, and you start working at the same time. It's the culture. It's crazy. She had a room this sort of size filled with 1,000 people. And I watched it, and for an hour and a half, their batteries drained away. They got nothing to do with mountain climbing, but she kept their attention because she told them stories that counted. And at the end of each little section, they had a takeaway, something to think about. And she took us from the US with the team all the way up Everest. And we're right at the top of Everest, 300 feet to go. 10 breaths per step is what you have to take. And a storm's coming in. And they turned back. We're sat there going, what? You said you climbed them all. This was our false hope moment. She took us right to the edge of it. And we went home. We couldn't stay any longer. We'd had the 2 months. And then she runs right through very quickly to another point in time when a member of the first team had died, good friend of them all. They went back a second time. This time their purpose had changed. 300 feet from the top of storms coming in. They looked at each other and they said, we're doing it. Every other team went back off the mountain. They went to the top and hunkered down. Different reasons why. So she took us to the climax very fast. So when you've got that story structure, it's not a standard width of each part of it. Sometimes you can have that last little section in just 5 minutes. Sometimes the whole story is about where you go through it. So those little embedded stories are great. And then I also mentioned earlier the whiteboard trick. Turn off PowerPoint. Think about your story. What your visual looks like. Get it on a page. And then go and meet your senior sponsor in their office. And chat with them. Get them engaged in it. And ask if you could use their whiteboard to show a few of the ideas. You know what that whiteboard's going to look like when you finish. Yeah, it's going to be a clear visual representation of this story and all the pieces linked together. And by the time you finish putting it up there and they're bought into it, the next guy comes in the room. Can I use your whiteboard? No, don't wipe that off. I need to keep that. I've managed to keep images on CIO's whiteboards for over 3 weeks. Really annoys the competition. So sometimes it's not about the PowerPoint. So we've got 10 minutes, and I'm going to fly through another example here that might be a little bit closer to home. A good friend of mine, J.D. Meyer, works on our enterprise strategy team now. He used to be part of Patterns and Practices, and he was involved in putting this one together, Mobile Application Architecture Guide, with a picture like this. Hands up in the room if you've never done a picture like this. Okay, we've got one. Are you an architect? Okay, he's not an architect. That's okay. But typically you have this. And I see so many presentations where architects or technical people put slides like this up and expect the stakeholders in the room to go, yes, I want one of those. I love the color of your boxes. Can I have it in purple? Yeah? No, you never get that answer. So let's tell the story about mobile with 3 slides. 3 key slides, and I'm going to use a whiteboard at the same time. So imagine I've got a whiteboard just here, okay? And that model is what I'm going to slowly draw on the whiteboard with a little annotation around it. I'm going to start by telling you about Jenny, who's a nurse. So Jenny works in the hospital where we're trying to do the work for this big program. We understand the changes she needs to have in terms of how she's going to capture data from patients. And for Jenny, it's all about devices like this that have got to work every time in her environment. So we talk about how to quickly establish one of these devices in the room, connect it to the network, ensure it's authenticated, that she is securely logged into it, so there's authentication about who's using the device and the data it's capturing, and for the patient that's associated with it. Very task-focused. We can tell the story of Jenny and draw the parts of the boxes from the diagram on the whiteboard that are relevant to what she needs to do. Now, this is a part of the story where it's very specific to the person, but it's also fairly easy. From a mobile architecture perspective, I've got 1 device with 1 user capturing a piece of data going onto a network. and I can talk about some of the tricky things like the authentication and the security in a simple space. I've set my initial context, and everybody in the room is going, oh, this mobile project is going to be easy. Unfortunately, it's not that easy. Because now what we've got is Darren, part of the clinical staff. He's mobile. He needs a device he can wander around with, and he's actually got a number of different things he's got to do, from checking in patients, to being able to provide information, to visiting relatives, to working with the nurse's schedules. So all of a sudden now, instead of a lockdown device, I've got a line of business application or two running on this device. It's not plugged in. So every now and then, he may need to change the device during the day to another one that's got its power up. So he's got to flip devices, re-authenticate. The situation just got more complicated. And I can expand the model to include that. Okay, I've got you now. We understand this mobility project. Every now and then, you can have two false hope dips if you want. So we're going to put another one in. You thought it was fixed. It's not. Say hello to Terry, he of the loud shirts. Terry is the head of operations, and boy, does he mess up the mobility model. Terry's got his desktop, his laptop, his new Surface device, his Nokia 1020 phone, and he's fully mobile. He has all his line of business applications he needs to work with. He's got spreadsheets. He's got stuff sitting in Office 365. He's a full Microsoft worker, because this place has got the all-you-can-eat enterprise agreement. You know, they've taken the works. But Terry, he's our challenge. How do you do mobility now with all these different devices and all these different data sources? Mobility is not the problem. Security is the problem, because Terry is an accident waiting to happen. He's got data that, if he got into the wrong hands, could put this organization on the front page of every national newspaper. So this is where you start to talk about the really hard stuff and the challenge of dealing with Terry's situation and other equivalent mobile workers. You're getting to see how to do it. How to take your normal style of presentation and turn it into something that you could use these short stories very quickly to introduce a segment and then spend 15 minutes talking about the issues and the technology behind it related to Terry. And that you as the audience are going to be approving this program, and different aspects of some of you are going to work with the nurses, some of you are going to be working with the doctors, some are going to be working with the operations people, so that you've got different challenges and how to bring them together. So I come back to now, why will your audience listen? Why will they care? In that mobility story, they care not because they love technology, but because, like most of us, they want to make a difference. And that when they can see the technology they deploy making a difference in the lives of the people in the hospital, they put the effort in to do it. So, all this content is available in Stories That Move Mountains. If you loved what you saw here, you can get the hard copy or the electronic copy. Follow the links and go join the Facebook page if you like. I've got 130 or so followers out there who are interested and ask questions every now and then, but we post to it on new ideas that we've seen. And in Microsoft, we have a whole community of storytellers that we've set up. They're not all part of our services business. They're all over our organization. The one thing we've got in common is we know we don't know enough about telling stories. So we tell each other stories about the experiences we've had. And if you think you've taken something away from this today, try it yourself. Your next presentation. Take a look at the CAS model, download it, and have a look and say, what do you do? And then spot the boxes you haven't filled in. Pick one of them, that's all, first time round, and do one thing differently that you haven't done before. Don't jump in with both feet into the deep end and try to do the full-on story presentation the first time. Take it a step at a time. There's 12 different boxes on there. You could take one a month for a year. And by the end of that year, you'll have totally transformed the way in which you create your presentations, you deliver them. And I would bet every single one of you, your colleagues and your stakeholders will see one heck of a difference in the way in which you try and communicate with them. This, on the right-hand side, is a version of the CAS model you can download from our website, Stories That Move Mountains, that has all sorts of little crib notes in there. And one of the versions we tell people you might want to create is the one-page poster. So you can take that, download it, and print it out. Pop it in your notebook or stick it on the wall in your office as a reminder of the sort of things you might want to do. And that is another part of my delivery plan. I entice you to come here. I've told you about it. Go and grab that, and that's a follow-up aspect as well. Yeah, you can download the PowerPoint deck, but you've seen how much is in my PowerPoint deck in terms of content you can read through afterwards. Not a lot. It's not a great handout. That's a handout that supports the materials and the ideas. Number of different medium that help support you in thinking about how to do what I've been talking about. You can go online later and watch the session I did earlier today if you want to understand a lot more about the benefits dependency network model that's behind our whole top row, how to really structure your content. And that's a much deeper approach than we actually use in the storytelling book, but the two work extremely well together. We've got our website. I'm here for as long as you want to ask me questions after this session. But please remember, they do like you to go and put the feedback in. I'd like to get the feedback as well. Have you enjoyed it? If there were issues, things you thought different, please let me know. Thank you for spending the time, and I hope you have a great evening.